Hello, this is the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Malcolm Turnbull hardly lets a media appearance pass without using the word innovation. It's become a one-word slogan invoked everywhere, including at the Paris Climate Conference. His government is soon to deliver its innovation statement, which will be its first big policy announcement. It recently appointed businessman Bill Ferris to chair Innovation Australia, and he's with us today. Bill Ferris, let's start with some of your own experience in this area. What were your early ventures? How did you get started? And were the failures as well as successes?
Well, Michelle, apart from my rock and roll band that I started at school and carried on through my university days, my first step, more seriously, was as I came out of the Harvard Business School second year program, I had looked at in the second year thesis program of the case for, tried to make the case for starting a venture capital business in Australia, because venture capital had taken off big time in the late 60s in the US capital markets, but we had nothing in Australia. So I did go on to form Australia's first venture capital, a very modest size company, modestly called International Venture Corporation. And that led me on to a whole career of venture capital and private equity investing.
What sort of areas were these businesses?
They were across a large number of sectors. We had one in the agribusiness area, which was a revolutionary feedstock business for ruminant animals, in particular cattle, based on a CSIRO technology, and we invested, did well with early trials, and finished up losing all our money, for example.
What happened?
The technology worked, which was a way of protecting, enabling the early stomachs to process more protein without toxicity and getting it through to the meat conversion process in the animal. So in a 30-day period, you could change the fatty composition of a whole cow quite convincingly, and indeed get it to produce low cholesterol fats, not harmful fats. But it cost a bit more, and the supermarkets were only interested if you would also market it. They wouldn't put any money behind this product. Mind you, it's decades ago, So it wasn't all that fashionable. We were a bit ahead of our time. Kind of happens in startups a lot. So it was but it didn't in the end get the traction we'd hoped for, and we couldn't afford to do the science work, the innovation into market, and pay for the extra promotional costs across the country.
Now, before we move into some specifics, just
we did have a few successes, I should say, and just quickly.
Do you want to go through those quickly?
No, but I mean the sorts of companies that you would know, Michelle, like Seek.com, and like LookSmart, one of the first search engine businesses, but also in manufacturing, the Gecko company, which had an innovative, wonderful processing plant, innovative process. So across number of industries and shipbuilding, the Austal Ships fast ferry business.
I notice you haven't been back to live animals, though.
Look, I don't think so, although we do. I still continue to have a very glass half full view of our agribusiness prospects.
Just talking about Innovation Australia, which you're chairing, what does it do exactly?
Well, it's a statutory authority, an independent statutory authority that's responsible for policy and strategic advice to its minister, which is the Minister for Innovation and Science and Industry, Christopher Pyne. It also oversees, if you will, the implementation of a variety of the government's innovation programs, so including the research and development grant schemes, the CRC, the Cooperative Research Centres, the growth centres, the entrepreneurship programs, which involve funding and advice of various sorts, and other programs aimed at from startups through SMEs through to larger corporations.
Now, what particular industries and sectors of the economy do you think are ripe for innovation in Australia?
Well, frankly, it's hard. You know, most sectors are ripe for innovation, and those that don't come through with it, we won't be talking about in the next 10 years' time. So although the excitement and the newness is in technology-intensive and frequently the digital delivery businesses and web-based business models, you can extend the excitement for innovation and the need for it to so many other sectors. Obviously, advanced manufacturing, agribusiness, we've already talked about, it's another one. The whole biotech and biomedical, be it molecules or medical devices, etc., is absolutely a spectacular opportunity for Australia. So there are many sectors that have to innovate, and that obviously this government is now intent on trying to accelerate that.
You've been a great supporter of the need to commercialise Australia's research discoveries and inventions. Just to narrow this down a bit, what are the most promising areas in which this sort of commercialisation can be boosted?
Well, I mentioned the biotech industry. Mm. I do think that the health and medical research status of our country, the research platform for discoveries and breakthroughs by the medical research institutes, by the university labs and others, is ranking now in the top three or four in the world. It's a remarkable achievement, and the great frustration is that it's big on R and not so big on D. So in the whole R&D for that sector, if you will, it's been research intensive and development money's deprived, and the real what we've got to watch is we don't squander that success of research, and we owe it to ourselves and nationally to make the entry to marketplace, to get through clinical trials of new things, of new devices, new drugs. We need to motivate the money and investing excitement in that, and bring things to market.
I must say, though, we've been hearing for decades the need to commercialise more of Australian research, and yet, well, we're still hearing it. So what are the problems? What's gone wrong that we haven't done more of it?
Well, it's a good question. The visiting chief scientist from Israel gave us some clues this last week when he spoke of the fact that the core to his country's success in commercialising, and they do rank, I guess, number one in terms of innovations per head and percentage of GDP contributed by innovation and so on, it was nothing more complicated than collaboration was the absolute core to all the success they've had. So he means collaboration by academia and business, with venture capitalists and government. They've been great at that. There are very big differences, obviously, between Israel and us in terms of existential risks and geographies and so on. But we have not been great at collaboration at all.
And why is that?
Well, one is the funding allocation metric. So if you're a researcher in a university, you need to publish and you need to be excellent and publish, but you don't need to demonstrate that you've got anything out to the marketplace. Now, you might if you're excited about it and you want to, but frankly, you're so busy doing what you have to do and writing your next grant application to get next year's research monies as well. So it's rational behaviour, but there hasn't been the... So one answer is there hasn't been the allocation metrics that says, okay, some demonstration of impact in the marketplace will influence the allocation of your research dollars. That we haven't had, really. And secondly, we've had a business community that, unlike in Silicon Valley or on the West Coast of America more generally, or Israel and elsewhere, it doesn't have a lot to do with the universities. A lot of small businesses, it's an amazing percentage. You know, they might know where the university is, but they don't go there, nor do they get invited there. I mean, I'm exaggerating to make the point, Michelle, that for us in Australia, we haven't got that together.
Well, one could argue, surely, that in a sense it's maybe not the small businesses' function, but it's businesses' role to get out and know what's done in the universities rather than the university's role to be out there marketing to specific businesses.
Yeah, no, I'd say it's a two-way thing. I do think that the taxpayers funding research nationally, and I'm all for that. I don't want to see our research go backwards, don't get me wrong. But ultimately, unless the researchers can, by hook or by crook, demonstrate that this work does get out for the benefit of the community with new things, with new cures, with new ideas and inventions and so on, I don't think they can go on and expect taxpayer support in the long term. So there's a mutual interest here. Business, for sure, you know, I think historically living in a small market economy, historically a long way away, certainly from if you're making physical products and services, not, you know, digital digitally delivered products and services, has created a sort of, in some senses, a fear of failure and not pushing the boat out too far in front, which you've got to do with an innovation process. And so just we're dealing with that.
Just before we unpack the fear of failure a bit, can you just outline what you would want to see from the innovation statement that we expect to see next week?
Well, I'd certainly like to see quite a lot said about collaboration and what can improve that. So I'd like to think that there will be some thought given to the metrics for universities and others to be able to demonstrate their engagement with industry and their interest in and progress with commercialization of some of the work coming out. I'd like to see similarly some incentives for business to bother with that other side of that transaction. And I think we will see some of that.
So we need new money here, extra money, you're saying?
Well, I think more money in the whole food chain from startups through SME expansion and into larger corporate and project work. Yes, you need more money. You'd certainly need more skills. You need more excitement. And when I say excitement, I mean a belief that Australians and Australian business and researchers need to grab hold of this and really learn to work together and achieve something for the nation.
In the budget, of course, we saw some tax incentives to try to get small business more active and stimulate that part of the economy. Do you think that tax incentives are needed for the innovation push?
You know, when you look at this whole innovation thing, you've got to think about stages of growth, because you get different answers and solutions possibly for, you know, you're talking seed capital or early stage or late stage or major corporations, you know. But to not dodge your question, I think, for example, the tax structure to encourage more individual involvement in startups, high net worth investors included, can be quite powerful as a motivator. So I would expect there will be some news on the tax front for that, certainly at the early stage level, but also for later stage investing, some improvement around the existing venture capital limited partnership structure and the early stage venture capital limited partner structures, which are administered by Oz Industry under Innovation Australia. I think we'll hopefully see some movement in that. And there's also roles for the government to co-invest. I'm keen on government and private sector money working together, not necessarily government money just on its own. There's a great role for major infrastructure projects by government on its own. So major science tooling, call it, but infrastructure is what I mean, for the sector as a whole across all sciences. Governments can do that, and private sector can't anywhere in the world, really. So there's a role there at the big end, and there's certainly a role at the other stages of growth as well, that I think we'll see some of that in this statement.
Critics might say this sounds like picking winners.
Well, I've say to, I know if you go through Canberra hallways, if you say winners, you've sort of got to go and wash your mouth out. I think it's ridiculous, personally. I've spent my whole life trying to pick winners or at least avoid losers. And happily
except
enough...
Except for the cows.
Except for the cows, yeah. I'll blame them. You don't kick too many goals if you don't kick many goals if you're not prepared to have some go behind, you know. And we need more of that. So
you don't mind the whole philosophy of picking winners?
Well, certainly for a private investor, obviously that's what you do.
For governments,
you've got to be more careful. You've got, in the sense of, you certainly got to be more politically careful. You can, and I think have to. You can't dodge the responsibility of thinking through and analysing what your, let's call them, the priority sectors. And I think governments now do talk about a half a dozen priority sectors for Australia. So you'll have some programs that are open access and should be, come what may, for what business you're in, I guess. But if you're really talking about what do you need over the next 10, 20, 30 years, you have to be thinking about what you've got some advantage in, where the markets are going, what the science is telling you, and lay some bets. Now, the government has already, certainly not me or Innovation Australia, the government's already identified, biomedical, agribusiness, advanced manufacturing, oil and gas, and so on. They're in front of your nose.
So let's just go back to the fear of failure, which you warn against. Isn't it a bit of a problem that you might have government money in something that is higher than average risk?
No, I think it's not. I think that governments have a great role to take higher than average risk. And if they don't, what else can they do? It's not just about ensuring equity through income distribution, which I think good democracies need to do more of. You got to do that. But if you're going to try and play any sort of leadership role in where you want your country to be in the future, you have to be prepared to understand the risks and sometimes share and indeed lead with that risk taking.
Even as a taxpayer. You've also, I think, argued that in Australia we have more fear of failure than we should have as a sort of community. Why do you think that is so?
Well, I do think the history is not irrelevant. I mean, if you go back to the colonial days, you are in a marketplace, you're a long way away from everybody else. On the one hand, you innovate with some good stuff because you have to, mother of all inventions, necessity. We did quite a bit of that. But if you take the early insolvency or bankruptcy style laws that came to this country from the get-go, they're draconian penalties if you didn't pay back creditors. Now, I'm not one for not paying back creditors, but those laws have become very intimidating.
Should they be loosened?
Well, I think there's a case for if you want people on your boards that aren't just ticking boxes, they're investing and they want to give advice and they want to be there to take the risks with you, and they're experienced. Young business people are going to finding it very hard to get those people on the boards because of the, more than anything else, the risk of trading, the test of trading while insolvent is a very intimidating one. And so there are some provisions in other countries, like the US have got what they call a Chapter 11 treatment that makes it a bit easier to manage through that. I think that needs a look at. Yeah, that's one set of reasons. I think the other is well, certainly we talked about distance from market and time to get to market and so on. That's been rational behaviour to concentrate, frankly, on your own marketplace. Then there's probably even the sort of tall poppy thing that's existed in the country that's held back a certain amount of, you know, in our society, if somebody's bankrupted or lost money, it's a badge of disgrace, not a badge of, well, he gave it a go. Whereas, you know, when I asked the chief scientist the other day from Israel, when he was visiting, what about the fear of failure there? Is that something he has to deal with? He said, what? He said, no, there's no fear of failure. People are expected to, the parents want their children to be entrepreneurs, and indeed the best, the sort of, as he described it, the gurus and the exciting personalities on campus, the universities and so on, they are, yes, they're some Nobel laureates, and the same professors will be chairing IPO floats for new companies and being involved in new enterprise. And so the entrepreneurship, if you're going to have a culture of entrepreneurship and give it a go, you've got to move on from fear of failure.
Just finally, it's rather innovative to have a 25-year-old assistant minister, Wyatt Roy, in this area. How do you think he's shaping up in his early days?
I tell you, well, he's very old. He's got an old head on a young body, hasn't he?
That's coming to Parliament early.
Yes, I suppose so. Look, I think the Prime Minister set an agenda with enthusiasm about the need for and the credibility of pushing innovation forward. You know, you have to manage expectations. I think Wyatt Roy has certainly picked up that. He obviously had it innately for the whole startup part of the ecosystem, and he's well informed on it and very genuine about pushing it. I think he's a good force, and like me, he'll have his failures too along the way and get strengthened by it.
Bill Ferris, thanks for talking with us today. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins, and we'll be back with another interview very soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.